Access number 30641, Mr. John Lenty, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about the advance into, well, towards Arnhem and then and into Belgium. What do you remember about this period?
That period was really one of waiting to go in and not being able to go in, because Arnhem, of course, was a major disaster, and there was nothing much, well, there was something we could have done, but we were just left waiting. The guards were in there, the guards brigade were in ahead of us, and they didn't get very far either. So after that, things were very quiet. We then went to a town called Mosaic in Belgium.
Now, how do you spell that?
Mosaic, which is just on the River Maas before you go across into Holland. And we were there for a few days, where everything you could possibly want was available, as it was in Belgium. Good food and restaurants and everything else. Shops were stocked well. And it was there that I saw the first girl who had her hair shorn off, because she'd been friendly with the German soldiers. By this time it was getting on to the middle of December, and it was very, very cold.
So there's about a 3-month gap there where not much happened, as far as you know.
Well, just the odd contact with the German army, and we lost a few.
Do you remember anything about that?
Not really, no. I don't know why not.
No, it's quite common that people don't remember fighting. Now, I mean, it's. So what's the next thing you do remember?
So from there we went across into Holland, and the bridge of Maas was still intact, but it was so cold and so much ice, so snow and ice, that we couldn't use the tanks, and we were made to work as infantry.
Now, what do you remember about that?
Well, we were boarded on we lived with a French farmer, with a Dutch farmer, who looked after us very well, and we really couldn't do a great deal. We were in trenches, and waiting for the Germans to come, but they didn't come. It was a very quiet period.
Was this during the Ardennes offensive?
No. Over Christmas, we're in December now.
That is the Ardennes offensive.
Well.
Is that why they brought you out and put you in trenches?
Well, no, they did that because it couldn't move. The tanks couldn't move across the ice. And then they decided that maybe we ought to go on, and we had to paint the tanks white to match the snow. And
now, who actually did that? Did you do that yourselves?
Yes, we did our own painting. Yes, we were supplied with paint and painted them. But we still couldn't proceed because the tanks just couldn't move.
Now, what were you doing at the time? Were you still in your armoured car?
Or? Yes, I was still in my armoured car. And,
same duties?
Absolutely, yes. We did a little bit of forward reconnaissance walking as infantry, but it was all pretty harmless.
So what's the next thing you remember?
Well, I suppose from there we slowly went up to the Rhine. There was very little resistance, as I remember it, but I may be quite wrong then. And crossed the Rhine, but don't ask me where, I cannot quite remember.
Would that be in March, or?
Oh, it must have been. It must have been March by then, yes. And there was not a great deal of resistance, but there were obviously odd skirmishes. And we lost a few tanks here and there, but the details I really cannot.
Anything notable happened to you, or were you not in the front line as reconnaissance?
We were not in the front line. And some of the time we were, but, you know, as an ordinary trooper, you really didn't know what was going on. You just lived from day to day and did as you were told. And eventually the weather improved a little bit, and we still had the tanks were still white, and we went across the Rhine into Germany, and our objective was a prisoner of war camp called Fallingbostel. Remember the spelling?
I know that one, sorry.
Where quite a few eighths of our people were locked up.
And what do you remember about the relief of Fallingbostel? I mean, what happened when you got there?
So it was a tremendous day, of course, especially we had our own people there. Alaska, our regimental sergeant major was there as well. It was hated like poison, so that but he was released as well. But we didn't stay there very long. They were taken back by a truck.
What was the condition of the prisoners?
Pretty good. Oh, yes. I think they'd had reasonable treatment, as most prisoners of war did in Germany, not in Russia, of course. And our next job was to push on towards Hamburg. And we got as far as a small town of Fischbeck, which is about 10 miles or 5 miles, whatever it was.
Fischbeck, as it sounds.
Like a German fish, F-I-S-C-H-B-E-C-K. And there we stopped. And it must have been April by then, middle of April.
Now, what sort of reception were you getting from any Germans you encountered?
Up to then, none at all. We were just suffered and we drove through. But I will remember in Fischbeck, a German delegation carrying a large white sheet was allowed through our lines in order to negotiate our possible entry into Hamburg. Hamburg had already been damaged pretty badly, and they lived in hopes that there would be no more fighting. So an agreement was made that we should enter Hamburg, I think it was the 2nd or the 3rd of May.
Now, you weren't parted, you weren't used as an interpreter or anything. Oh, no, this is just your history.
I'm sure they spoke perfectly good German. And the mayor of Hamburg was there and some army generals, but I can't remember who they were.
But you saw them coming through your lines.
Yes. Of course, we were all very elated. And the agreement was that we would go into Hamburg with the German army on duty, the police on duty, the anti-aircraft guns, which were mostly on the Alster and around there, being fully manned. And so we did, and we drove into Hamburg, led by one of the trooper who was born in Hamburg and knew Hamburg, and he led us in. And I'm still in touch with his wife now. She lives in America. Anyway, so it was rather an eerie feeling. I was in the advance party to drive in. And we drove straight to one of the big hotels, which was called the Atlantic. And the officers, of course, were billeted inside the hotel, and we were in the gardens under canvas. And so, on May the 8th.
Now, there wasn't that much. I mean, Hamburg had been well bombed. What was it? Tell me what the state of the...
I would say 60% of the houses were destroyed. But lots of Germans came out and waved to us and welcomed us. Well, Hamburg was always a very international town. And I think they probably knew which side the plane was battered. And so we were very well received, but of course they had nothing to eat, and much the same as the rest of Germany. Especially it was a big town and a big port.
Now, tell me about the end of the European War. What do you remember then?
Well, I remember very distinctly. Remember the May the 8th, which was the day the war ended. We were still in the Atlantic Hotel, and we had a party, but it was all very quiet. And don't forget, we lost a lot of people, so did everybody else, and we didn't really know what the future held for us. It was very...
How did you feel yourself?
I felt elated, and of course by that time I knew that my parents had been deported. I got to know via Switzerland, through my sisters, that they were no longer alive. But obviously I was anxious to find out what really happened to them.
Did you find out then, or was it much later?
A little later. Shortly after the May the 8th, the 8th were ordered to go into Denmark for rest and a refit, or retire, anyway, R&D, as the Americans would call it. be, but on the way we went through a town called Itzehoe, I-T-Z-E-H-O-E, which where there were thousands and thousands of German soldiers, and we had to disarm them all and take their arms off them and destroy their arms, which we did by driving our tanks over all the rifles. And I have a photo of it, but that is in the Itzehoe Museum now. And the colonel decided that we should have an exhibition of concentration camp photos. And so we had rigged up a little gallery.
Now, at Itzehoe?
Yes, and all the prisoners of war had to file past them. But needless to say, none of them admitted that they had any knowledge of the existence of the camps. When we got almost to the Danish border, we were told to stop and turn round, and we were to go to Berlin for the victory parade. But before we could do that, of course, the tanks and all the vehicles and everything had to be smartened up.
Now, how much of a bull thing was that? What do you remember of that?
Oh, I think we were all very elated when we got to know that we were going to Berlin, but it was a long drive, of course. And I don't think we knew then it was going to be the victory parade, but we knew we were going to Berlin. But of course Berlin at the time was occupied by the Russians entirely. So we went by road all the way into Berlin. Some of the tanks were on tank carriers, but quite a few were by road. And we had a very, very slow journey up to Helmstedt, which was the border between the Russian zone and the British zone, where we had great difficulty, not we of course, but the officers, to negotiate our entry into the Russian zone. But we then drove slowly up the motorway into Berlin, but we were held up several times on the way by Russian soldiers, but eventually we made it, and we were told to proceed to the Olympic Stadium. Our tanks were to be parked in the middle of the Olympic Stadium, and we were to occupy the surrounding buildings, which had been used for accommodation in the 1936 Olympics. When we got to the premises, the buildings, they were absolutely filthy. The Russians had occupied them, and the rooms were being used as public lavatories. Everything was so filthy that we went into the surrounding streets and rounded up a large number of women and forced them to make the accommodation habitable. The great day came on July the 21st, 1945, of course, for the victory parade, when the route was taken by Churchill, Montgomery, Eden, Attlee and Alexander. And Churchill made a rousing speech at the time, from which I can quote an extract. He said, "The desert rats were the first to be in action in the desert in 1940, and ever since you've kept steadily marching forward in the long road to victory. Dear desert rats, may your glory never die. May your glory ever shine. May your laurels never fade. May the glory of this glorious pilgrimage of war never fade. May the fathers long tell their children about this tale."
What did you think of Churchill and his speech? You know, his speech.
It was very emotional, yeah. But of course,
what was the parade? What do you remember of the parade? How big an affair was it?
It was a big, masses of photos on the internet. It was a very long parade, but we were the leading regiment, and
leading British or
no, they were all British.
It was a British, yeah.
We were the British zone, of course. You remember Berlin was divided into four zones, and we had the zone that went up as far as the Brandenburg Gate, and No, it was a very, very memorable day, but the evening news, which was in existence at the time, splashed the headlines. That evening, the evening news had the headlines and a photo of the leading tank, and the four people who were in it, and they got every name wrong, as usual. We then went back to barracks and wondered what was going to happen next.
And so that's back to the Olympic Stadium.
Back to the Olympic Stadium, yes. And I don't remember any other activities except that I and a few others who spoke German fluently, or alleged to be able to speak German fluently, were asked to go to on an interpreter's course. And which I did, but two of us were the only people who could speak English properly, failed.
So just to repeat, then, that's after a short spell in Berlin, the army decided that I'd be more useful as an interpreter, and I went on a course at the end of which a friend and I...
Now, what do you remember of the course? Where was it at, and what were you doing?
Where was it at? I can't remember where it was at, but I can probably find it. Somewhere in West Germany, it wasn't in Berlin.
And what were they teaching? I mean, you could already speak German and English.
I think they were trying to see whether we were good interpreters and how good our German was. And maybe my German wasn't good enough, I don't know. Anyway, we were told we hadn't passed, and so all the others got three stripes, and we only got two, by this friend of mine and I.
Were you still going to be used as an interpreter?
Oh, yes. And then we had 7 days home leave, and I was posted back to Berlin and attached to the Australian military mission.
Now, were you still a member of the Hussars?
No, in the meantime, I'd been transferred to the 23rd Hussars, and don't ask me why. But I never wore the insignia. I always kept the 8th Hussars.
So when did you leave them? When was this course? July or August?
It must have been July, round about July, yes.
So you'd leave the unit in August, essentially?
Something like that, yes.
Now, so who are you with now?
I was now with the Australian military mission. I was attached to them as the only non-Australian.
And you were an interpreter?
I was supposed to be an interpreter, yes.
And where was the Australian military mission based?
It was in the Reichstrasse, R-E-I-C-H-S Strasse, which was very near the Olympic Stadium. It was a beautiful old large house which had been requisitioned. It was still in good condition. And our staff there consisted of, they're all Australians, a brigadier, a sergeant major, two corporals, and a driver who had been a prisoner of war, released, but he didn't want to return home. And that was the staff of the mission. We employed a chef who had been the head chef of the Bremen, which was a large German luxury liner before the war, and cleaners and maids and gardeners and things.
What was the role of the unit?
Our brief was to find Australian prisoners of war, war graves, and Australian property. Not a very arduous assignment. I don't think we spent a great deal of time at it unless we were given some tip-off as to where these people could be found. We did deal with a few prisoners of war, but by and large we did everything but act in the capacity in which we were supposed to act. We had this... The brigadier had a six-seater Humber, which we used for weekends to go to Brussels and spend our time there.
On recreation, I mean, not on duty.
No, not on duty. No. Didn't do much duty.
So what were the visits to Brussels like?
Oh, very pleasant, because as I said previously, they had everything. Well, I distinctly remember one occasion when I was in Berlin, and I put up in a small hotel near the station, And I was waking up in the middle of the night, be told that I was in a brothel, and I was turfed out. But mainly spent our time eating and drinking and generally wandering around. But we were only there for a night or two at a time. So in Berlin, of course, was a disaster. It was.
Now, what do you remember of the state of Berlin?
I mean, it was terrible. It was wherever you went, except around the Olympic Stadium, it wasn't too bad. But inner Berlin as everybody knows, it was extremely badly damaged. And wherever you looked, there were German women busy trying to salvage bricks and other building materials and trying to board up windows and generally try to make life as acceptable as possible. And by that time, of course, the black market was ripe.
How aware were...
The black market was mainly the British side of the Brandenburg Gate. It was part of the Tiergarten. But we weren't allowed there, of course. Officially.
What was going on there? What did you know about the black market?
Well, they were selling cigarettes and coffee and all the things were not available. Most of the goodies having been supplied by the American forces and the British, to a lesser extent the British forces. But I don't think many soldiers went there. They may have gone there. Well, I don't think I had any civilian clothes, so I couldn't have gone there anyway.
Now, what about the non-fraternization?
Yeah, I'll come to that in a minute.
Okay.
The most depressing part, just the Russian side of the Brandenburg Gate was a huge hotel. It was probably the best in Berlin, if not in Germany, called the Adlon, Adlon, which has since been rebuilt. It's still the premier hotel in Berlin. And just outside is an underground station. And that underground station was used as an air raid shelter. And for some reason, I think a bomb must have hit a water main. And there were about 500 people in this underground station. And they were all drowned. And they were still down there. And of course, the smell from there was just terrible. But there was virtually no traffic. Of course, there were no cars, a few buses were running, and the only vehicles you saw were the military. Berlin, as I said before, was divided into four zones, French, British, Russian, and American. And in those days, we were allowed into all the zones. The Germans couldn't change from one zone to the other, but we could. And so we went to Potsdam and visited places outside, visited the eastern part of Germany where the Russians were, which was bedecked with Russian flags, red flags, of course.
How were you treated when you went there? I mean, were you...
No, reasonably. We weren't to Pali. Anyway, we couldn't communicate with them because most of the Russian soldiers that one saw in the street were ordinary ranks, and they were mostly simple folk from the backwoods, and villages and so forth, and they were totally uneducated. And they were just gun fodder. That's, after all, how the Russians managed to win the war. But they used to come. We had two big NAFIs, which were the sort of army clubs. And they used to come up there and swap watches for pistols. That was the great trade amongst the troops. And the troops themselves were amply supplied with cigarettes and chocolates and things from the NAFI. Well, there was a limit on what you could buy, and they either sold this or traded it for other goods, and there was an enormous amount of business going on. Illegal, of course. Non-fraternization was allegedly strictly enforced, but it didn't really work.
Why not?
Well, men being what they are, they found themselves girls. I knew quite a few who had regular girlfriends, so we just had to be careful not to be seen in public.
So you had pretty well minimal duties at the time?
Minimal, yes. I had a very, very privileged life. I was then promoted to staff sergeant, which meant I could go to the sergeant's mess in the NAFI, which was rather better than the others.
And what was the sergeant's mess like? What did it offer you? Why was it better?
Well, I suppose it was more comfortable, and the lounges were more comfortable. I can't remember. It may well be there was better food. I really don't remember. Then I used some of my cigarette ration to acquire a large collection of records. Gramophone records from a shop which had survived and had quite a good stock, and I still have that, although it is a 78, so I don't play them anymore. And one evening I was coming back from, I must have been to a concert or an opera or something, which was already very much active then. And I was standing in on the underground train next to a lady, and somehow we got talking. And she and I both got off at the same stop. She lived about 200 yards in the other direction to my accommodation. And we've got very friendly. She had a nice. She was of Russian father, rather Russian mother, and her father was German. She herself was a qualified dentist, but wasn't working at the time. And we agreed to meet again, and eventually we became very close friends. But of course, we could not be seen together in public. As a result of total coincidence, we happened to sit next to each other at concerts and operas, and my rather belated return to the mission was not noticed, or at least not commented upon, because I was by no means the only one who had a German girlfriend by then. She, of course, did quite well, because she had gifts from otherwise unobtainable items, in particular the Australian Comforts Fund supplied the mission extremely well, and I think we were, of the troops in the British sector, we probably had more goodies than anybody else. We had chocolates and cigarettes and all the usual things.
How did you get on with the Australians? I mean,
I got on extremely well. They were careful, apart from the driver, they were very carefully selected, and a very civilised lot, and the brigadier was hardly a brigadier. I can't remember what his profession was, but he was a civilised gentleman, and we all got there. Well, just a few of us. And then we managed to keep ourselves occupied, and the winter 40 or 40, 45 was very severe, and so we got a few German lads in and converted the garden into an ice rink, and we were ice skating in our garden. And we had a very good time altogether. In fact, the time was so good that one was reluctant to think about demobilization. But